I think Martin gave us a very nice kind of overview of some of the issues and highlighted for me a couple of papers that I should have seen but didn't. What I call Schimmel's Law of the Literature is you can either keep up with the literature or you can contribute to it, but you can't do both. With all of the inherent contradictions implied within that. I sort of became a tundra ecologist by accident when I got a job at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, but the tundra's been one of my loves for a long time, and we've been working up there on frozen soils for quite a while, and the crew that has really done the work, so when I say we did something, you know who that really means. It was some member of this team, including Kara Bilbro, Claudia Boot, Kate Buckridge, Shauna McMahon, Carl Mikan, Sean Schaefer, Sita Sistla, Matt Wallenstein, or Mike Weintraub, and these have now been spread over some period of years. But very little of the work was actually done, of course, with my own hands, some of it. And I apologize for the stupid title. When I was first invited to participate, I didn't really know what I wanted to talk about. But the action is underground. The thing about tundra soils is that ground is a very weird concept for soil scientists. The reaction almost all of us who've ever started working up there has been to look at this stuff that we call soil and say, that soil? This stuff that an area from Tussock is made of is still the woven dead roots that are, you know, 1 to 200 years old and still intact. But that's where the plants are growing, and that's the soil. It's an organic soil. When we're looking in the intertussock zones or in shrubbier areas, this live stuff that's moss is also the dead stuff that, again, plants are growing in. So organic soils are a little bit weird and take many of us a bit to get our heads around. They're not what we're used to. But one of the other really critical things about Arctic soils is they're incredibly sensitive to environmental change. So if we look here at controlled tussock tundra and fertilized tundra over here, it looks rather different. And this shift from tussock tundra, open sedge and moss dominated systems, to shrubby systems is one of the really critical phenomena that occurs in Arctic systems. And while tussock tundra is kind of unique to Alaska and eastern Siberia, the hummock tundra of Canada is quite similar in some ways. Of course, if you warm it, you quickly can take things to something that also looks very, very shrubby, much more woody vegetation. This from the Tulik Field Station LTER experiments. And if you combine these treatments, you can, in about 10 years, turn something that used to look like this into a birch forest. And this is not the most woody of the greenhouse vert plots at all. So these transitions between vegetation types are critical. It changes everything about the system. So these are the bacterial community composition in tussock tundra throughout winter. What you see is a lot of these acidobacteria that are almost absent in shrub tundra. So that transition changes not only the plant communities, but of course the soil communities, and also the nature of nutrient cycling between these. So this is results from a lab incubation study that Mike Weintraub did, and when we incubated tussock soils in the lab for over a year and respired almost a third of the total carbon that had been in that soil away as CO2, this is the net nitrogen mineralized, and it remained zero despite the fact that a third of the carbon was gone. Shrub tundra, on the other hand, starts mineralizing nitrogen very quickly and continues to ramp up over the course of a year. These intertussock samples are sort of intermediate. So the shift between vegetation types changes everything about these soils. And as we start talking about what happens in cold conditions, this tussock shrub kind of transition will be important as well. What limits microbial activity in tussock tundra is nitrogen. There's tons of carbon, they can use it, but if we do a nitrogen fertilization study, this is a lab incubation, adding in increases respiration, it increases microbial biomass, it increases enzyme activities, it even increases the substrate use efficiency of the microorganisms. They assimilate more carbon when you give them nitrogen from an added glucose source. So they're so nitrogen limited that they can't even make the enzymes they need or effectively use the carbon that they do access. So this is really what limits decomposition in tussocks. But that's not true in shrub soil. So that in the growing season, we built this hypothesis that as shrubs increased with warming, shrubs had produced more woody material. As a result of that, their organic matter, instead of being this vast pool of easily accessed lignocellulose, becomes more of this mix of more woody material and more litter. So small labile active fraction that cycles rapidly that increases nitrogen availability in these soils and that reinforces this shrub feedback. And so this shrubification of the Arctic is a big deal in the growing season. And the impacts of that. Well, if you look at this landscape, one thing you see is the shrubs are dark. So they change the albedo and they change the entire energy exchange with the atmosphere, both between radiative transfer and moisture and latent other kinds of heat. But also in the winter, shrubs stick up above the snow cover. So here we're transitioning to winter. They dramatically change the albedo of the system, the energy balance. They reinforce warming. They trap snow. They prevent it from blowing around and sublimating and from forming sort of these sheets of very densely packed snow. So there's more snow. It's thicker. It insulates the ground better. This, of course, affects everything else that lives in these areas. Caribou don't like trying to tramp through this stuff. So as you go to more woody vegetation, everything in the tundra will change. Caribou expect to disappear. More moose will appear. But as we then transition from working in this lovely conditions of the warm summer, it was over 80 degrees Fahrenheit at Tulik Lake this summer. This is an older picture. And Mats, you may recognize Doris Grellman from Umeå. To what we're really talking about here, which is working in these conditions. This was a nice balmy day in Tulik Field Station in November. It was only 25 below zero Fahrenheit. What's going on then? And here, it really poses the questions of, are microbes active during the winter? And Martin really already answered that. I'll show a little bit more to highlight that point. Are those processes important, you know, in terms of overall ecosystem functioning? And this really is one of the important ones. Are the processes just slower? Do microbes just slow down when you dial down the temperature below zero? Or are they doing different things? And how does that feed into these patterns of landscape change that drive tundra ecosystems? And the other last question really is, are microbes growing under these winter conditions? Are they accumulating cell biomass? Are they replicating cells, or are they just in a starvation survival mode and just burning carbon to try to stay alive, as I think we do when we're, you know, when we're up there working in those conditions? So microbes do respire down to temperatures at least to minus 10. I've never been happy with the Panikoff paper because all my permafrost guys say, yeah, below minus 10, there's no unfrozen water left in the soils, and I don't know how you respire when there's no unfrozen water, but the data are really quite compelling. But certainly down in the near sub-zero, between 10 and 30% of total annual gross, you know, carbon respiration from soils seems to be during the frozen period. I mean, it is three-quarters of the year, and it may only be 10% of the carbon. Some things are slower. But when we look at the net carbon exchange, in the growing season, plants are photosynthesizing and soils are respiring, and that system is very, very tightly in balance. In the winter, all the carbon export, all the carbon flux is out. And so winter can control whether tundra systems are a source or a sink of carbon. And given how much carbon is in those soils, that's a big deal. And since winter is when things are expected to warm the most in the tundra, the shift in, you know, small numbers can be a very big effect. So yes, they are active, and that is important. It's not only microbes that seem to be active when soils are frozen. This is a photo taken in May looking at the bottom of a 3-foot snow pit, and the plants are green and growing already. So plants, I think, under snowpack are something we've been ignoring as well. But as soon as you start getting up into that -2 range, everything live in the soil starts turning on. Fresh green sedges, nice leaves, and this is something I've paid no attention to up to now, and I think that's a lack. So when we look at the winter dynamics, we've built another conceptual feedback loop between climate warming and shrubs, and we know that with warming we're seeing more shrubs on the landscape, as illustrated by these photos, 2005 relative to 1950. Shrubs do increase snow depth. That is a truth. Increased snow does increase soil temperature. When you go from, thin slab snow to meter deep fluffy snow, you can take temperatures from -20 up to around -5, and with Q10s potentially of 100 or 200, that's huge. Increased soil temperature, we know, increases microbial activity, as strong Q10s down to at least -10. And then that raises the question of, increased microbial activity should increase nutrient availability in the soil, and we know that shrubs respond to nutrients. So in a paper that Matt Sturm led a big synthesis effort on, we built this other conceptual feedback loop. And I want to sort of look at some pieces of this, sort of ignoring this side because we know these are truths at this point. That's simple physics, and physics is simple. Bacteria don't read textbooks, but insulation does. So one of the things that we noticed early on, this was work that Carol Bilbro did, was looking at net nitrogen mineralization through the winter and the effects of temperature on that. So to do this, we took soil cores in September and put them in the ground and then harvested them sequentially through the year. So, and then looking at ammonia in those cores. And looking first at this yellow line, which is the ambient conditions in tussock tundra, in the early part of the season, as things are accumulating snow, are still fairly warm. Remember that as soils are freezing, it takes quite a while to drop below zero, but then temperatures can drop very quickly. A significant amount of nitrogen was mineralized. In the deep cold of winter, very little happens in the ambient. And then as things warm up into the growing season, nitrogen's reimmobilized. In a snow fence experiment where the temperatures never went below around -5 at the coldest, the early part of the season was identical to the control. But that's when snow's accumulating, and so the snow fence effect is minimal. But then in the deep part of winter, there's still a little bit of net accumulation of ammonia. As soils warm at the end, that increased. Now, to put this into perspective, 800 milligrams of nitrogen is enough to support the entire annual demand for above-ground plant growth. That's a lot of nitrogen that's sitting in the soil at the end of winter and was immediately immobilized by microbes. These were in intact cores that the nitrogen went away. And so this really highlighted the shift between winter metabolism that seems to be releasing, it is mineralizing nitrogen, and then this transition to the thawed season nitrogen-limited condition. So microbes are clearly doing something different in the winter than they are in the growing season, and that transition between frozen and thawed was a big deal. Well, what was that? So we did one experiment, and this was work I did with Carl Meekin, where we used a C14 isotope pool equilibration technique. This is not isotope dilution to measure rates. This is we squirted some C14 glucose into the soil. That labels the actively turning over microbial biomass and products pool, because that C14 will be turned over through this and will label that pool. And that leaves then one small labeled pool, and we can measure the enrichment of biomass, and one big, completely unlabeled pool. And then by measuring respiration, we can do an isotope, mixing model of, if biomass is enriched to 100 units and this is zero and the CO2 is 50, well, half the carbon's coming from this MBNP pool. So it's a very useful technique. There are some assumptions that, those boundaries aren't quite as sharp, but we don't have to worry about those. It's rough, as is all things, all measurements in soil. And we found a few things that we expected and a few things that surprised us dramatically. As anticipated, when soils are warm, so these are different soils, this is all the tussock tundra soils, going from 5 down to 0 and then down to -8. When soils are warm, or at least thawed, most of the carbon respired comes from plant detritus. That's the soil organic matter. When soils are frozen, most of the carbon, or more of the carbon, a significantly increased fraction, is coming from this microbial biomass and products pool, turning over their cells, turning over their stuff, the stuff that's still available in liquid water films. It wasn't always a very big number, except in some of these really deep soils. But it is an increase, and that's kind of what we expected. And then actually it jumps enormously in some of these soils as you go down towards minus 10, which is also interesting. One of the really weird things that struck us in this study was that this transition is abrupt, and it happens above zero. We'd anticipated seeing this shift down at minus 2 when you get bulk freezing. So this looks kind of like microbes go frost hardening or pre-acclimating to the fact that it's about to freeze, which is a very rational thing to do. But it also means that for this long period that microbes are, or that soils are sitting at zero as they're freezing, they're already in this cold season metabolism pattern. And I think that's really important. Now, this is a calculation we did in that same paper I've never been very comfortable with, but the data was suggest that while the respiration from just the detrital material shows this fairly continual Q10 kind of relationship, that as you get down to that minus, or just above zero rather, plus 0.5, that there's an actual increase in the respiration from microbial biomass and products. It's not just that this drops more than this. So it really looks like microbes are kicking up some metabolic processes to deal with the fact that it's cold. And then that sort of shuts or slows down as you go below zero. So what is this metabolism that's occurring, and are the microbes actually synthesizing stuff, or are they just burning carbon faster? And to sort of combine both of those questions into one, we did a study, we, in this case, meaning Shauna McMahon as part of her PhD, looking at patterns of metabolism and the fate of carbon compounds. So thinking about what a microbe does with a compound like glutamate when it's taking it up and metabolizing it, it can use it, microbes can use glutamate as a carbon source, in which case you would expect to see some of this carbon showing up in lipids and the like. And if you see a lot of glutamate carbon showing up in carbon, pure carbon skeletons, you might say that indicates carbon limitation. But they can also use glutamate, of course, as a nitrogen source. It's an amino acid. It's ideal to just shunt straight into proteins. And if you see it showing up in protein or not in lipids, you might anticipate that it was N-limited. So we did a study where we added C13 glucose as just a reference for labile carbon. Where does simple carbon go? And glutamate to look at how does nitrogen metabolism change. And we followed it into PLFAs. We did the work. This was, this is a nice sunny day in May, drilling soil cores, pounding them up so that you can actually add liquid compounds to frozen soils, grinding them up in the blender and then working in the cold, because this is what a tussock looks like in the winter. This isn't really winter, of course, it's spring, but you never. If you live in Texas, it looks like winter. And then what we did was we looked at several different biomarkers. So here's a bacterial biomarker, glucose in blue, glutamate in red, winter, summer. In winter, the same amount of these two compounds shows up in this biomarker. So this looks like, yeah, they're using glutamate as a carbon source, which is consistent with what we saw from N mineralization. In the winter, microbes seem to be N-limited. In the summer, we see this shift. Glucose is still going into lipids, glutamate less so. So a shift from carbon to nitrogen limitation. But they're synthesizing new cell biomass here. This is a measure of growth. Fungi show the same pattern, but less so. Glutamate always in fungi seems to be used more as a nitrogen source than relative to glucose. In the summer, fungi were not putting any glutamate carbon into lipids. They were metabolizing all of each of these in each of these times. So again, we see this shift. Winter, more carbon limitation. Summer, more N limitation. And this is in tussock soils. Shrub soils, the data are a little bit more complicated, but show very consistent patterns with what we've seen. This is, again, a bacterial biomarker. In the summer, glutamate still being used as a carbon source. Glutamate's always used as a carbon source by bacteria in shrub soils. In contrast to tussock tundra, but in very consistent with this idea of shrub soils are nitrogen rich. Fungi, a similar pattern, always more evidence of N limitation in shrub soils, but you know, not to the same extent. So bacteria use glutamate as a carbon source in summer. They're still carbon limited, different from tussock tundra. Fungi don't like using carbon glutamate as a carbon source as much. They're more nitrogen limited. And this may be because the fungi are mycorrhizal and they're just shunting it straight off to the plants. So what these data are showing is that this pattern of carbon versus N limitation, at least in tussock soils and tussock tundra soils, is very consistent from whether you're looking at sort of gross levels of biogeochemical processing or the very patterning in which microbes are allocating carbon at the biochemical level. I mean, it's really nice when you see those kinds of very broad coherence. So are they, but the next question in terms of growth, are they replicating? So we looked at using bromodeoxyuridine incorporation into DNA and then fingerprinting and sequencing to follow up on this. Who is growing? Are they actually growing in terms of replication? And looking at, this is bacterial community patterns in tussock soil. This is the bulk community. And our hypothesis was summer communities should look like the bulk total unlabeled UnBRDU labeled DNA. Winter communities should look different. In tussock tundra soils, nothing ever looks like the bulk community in the BRDU profiling, which is interesting. How do these organisms get there if they never can grow? Or maybe they just don't assimilate BRDU. But there's some overlap between winter and summer. They're not as completely different in these conditions. So active is not the same as the bulk community, but summer and winter, there's some divide, but it's not complete. Shrub soils are kind of different. Here's the bulk community. Again, it looks quite different than anybody else in this sort of ordination plot. This is the active summer community. It's distinct. But winter communities are completely different than summer communities in the bacterial community in shrub soil. So again, we're seeing this, that plant communities are hugely important in controlling what happens, and summer versus winter is an enormous shift in who's doing things. And the seasonality of winter shows up here, too. Early winter is a completely different active community than late winter, even though temperatures aren't that different. So are microbes active during the winter? Yes, indeed. We're still figuring out who they are, but they're active. Are the processes important? Enormously so. Martin showed some data on N2O, CO2. If in these seasonal environments, if you ignore winter, you're missing the boat. In the past, in the Arctic, September came along, summer was over, it's time to go back and teach classes. Last one out, turn out the lights. All the fun is happening in the dark. Do microbes just slow down, which is what most biogeochemical models assume, or do they do different things? They do different things because of these different physiological patterns and different active organisms that are responding to the different environment. And that means different dominance of organisms who are active, and it means different physiology. So this is a case where understanding the microbial physiology may be critical to actually getting the overall biogeochemistry right. So we come back to this feedback, these things happen. We're doing, I think, a pretty good job of understanding these links in terms of what are the microbial activities. It's a nuisance trying to do physiology in frozen soils because most of our techniques require adding liquid water. We have some techniques that I think are at least reasonably adequate for doing this. But the last point is in understanding how these tie together and close the loops, these big issues that I think we've not been focusing on very much, is the links between we can mineralize nutrients in the winter. Do they actually close the feedback loop to reinforce the shrubification of the Arctic? This, I think, does remain an open question and it really starts tying back to plants and mycorrhizal ecology rather than just pure soil microbiology. Thank you. I think I have some time for questions.
We have time to take a few questions.
I talk too fast.
Can you show a data on unsaturated fatty acids? It's well known that the microorganisms will adapt the degree of unsaturation to the temperature.
We did. I mean, in this work, we looked at, you know, the complete suite of PLFAs. Just for these, we picked a couple of fairly robust biomarkers. We expected to see in the winter a shift towards shorter fatty acids and a shift towards more unsaturation. We didn't see that. Actually, in the winter, we saw some really long fatty acid lipids that we did not see in the summer. So some of the patterns that we expected to see did not show up, which seems to be the normal thing I find, that what we expect microbes to do. They, under stressed conditions, they don't necessarily, at least in these sort of large-scale summer-winter transitions, many of those things may be things that individual organisms do to survive some of the intermediate stresses, but come the deep cold of winter, I think they don't. I mean, we see similar things with like osmoregulation and dry soils in California. You know, all the things we thought that organisms did from pure culture studies, they don't. And for reasons that may not be that surprising given the nature of the environments. Yeah, Peter.
Josh, that when you label up with the glucose,
uh-huh,
feeling about where that glucose is going. So in other words, when you're looking at that higher turnover, low temperature,
uh-huh,
I think that's dying biomass or reserves. You know, it's just they're hanging in there, but they're burning up reserves. Any feeling?
I'm not sure. What we do see is a lot of when you add a very, and what I love about the C14 and, you know, techniques is you don't have to add very much, and so you can use a very small tracer. In the frozen soils, the challenge is first where it's going physically, and so we actually, you know, pound things up with a hammer and then blend them to get them down to very fine grains so that we don't have to thaw the soils and refreeze them. Physiologically, I don't know. I would have hypothesized that what we saw in that MBNP and turnover was that this was sort of stress respiration, that they were doing stuff to deal with that. And I'm not convinced that I understand what bacteria do under these conditions. And we didn't really look at where the carbon goes in terms of other, you know, compounds in that study. Yeah.
Among your shrub community, are there any
We're looking at in shrub tundras mostly birch and willow, so not. And most of our models of shrubification are based on the idea of birch, which is what you often see expanding. In that photo where you see those big dark patches and the little this one here, those are alder. In the big river valleys where you see these really big dark expanses, there's a lot of alder expanding in some of those communities. And we haven't gotten out there, but that's something I'd really like to look at, because, of course, that completely screws up all of these nutrient feedback dynamics. I understand there are some sort of halos of birch around some of those areas as well that just don't show up as much on a long-distance photo, because a tall birch in the tundra is still only about yay tall. But the role of N fixers in some of these communities is completely, not completely, it is very poorly studied. And I think that's a limitation of the science we've been doing. We need to understand alder better.
Have you looked at the species composition in the, as it converts from the tussock to the wooded tundra? Are you seeing a different form development in the birds? Are you seeing a different species? Or are they simply changing their phenology with response to increased nitrogen?
The birch themselves, all that happens is they increase their secondary woody growth. That doesn't even seem to be very much in the plots in terms of birch recruitment. It's mostly expansion of these shrubs that are already part of the community. And in terms of transitioning tundra to woody plants, that's an important distinction because tree line advance is very slow. But birches and willows are spread through these environments and they can pop up quite quickly and dramatically and just expand who's there. In terms of some of the shifts in microbial communities and particularly things like mycorrhizal dynamics, I think there's some interesting questions there too. But again, the microbes are probably already there, even though we see very different transitions. The problem, of course, is that some of what we've been doing is using more endpoints, and getting that transition as birch expands is a tricky thing. So we've been working in those greenhouse plots a lot where there's been no fertilization. The increases are purely due to just warming. But, you know, there's four of them. They're only about the size of this, you know, table, a little bit bigger than that. And they're kind of trashed now is the problem, and they were 20 years old, but they're hard to sample reliably anymore. We have usually tried to minimize the amount of smashing up of things if we can when we've done lab incubations, except when we're adding substrate.
The reason I ask is just because the larger pores in those soils are going to freeze first, and I would imagine that you'd get some sort of freeze distillation and concentration of solutes into the smaller pores.
Well, remember, these are not mineral soils. Don't think about pore space and pore structure the way we're used to it. They're sponges that are freezing. And so the whole kind of way we think about soil is a little bit different. So I don't know quite how sort of the freezing and substrate movement is operating in these systems. There certainly is some, but there aren't hard surfaces with pores. I mean, it's all porous at different scales. Even when soils are frozen, most of what seems to get respired is unlabeled unmicrobial carbon. So microbes are still acting on some of that detrital material. We've done, you know, 2-year-long incubations in the cold to see if we would actually run out of labile carbon, and they just keep cruising along at a very constant rate, similar to what we'd seen during thawed incubations. So I think microbes and their enzymes continue to access some of that detrital polymers and to use it. And the main issue may be diffusion of immediate substrates to microbes. But again, there is more carbon there. The microbes are carbon saturated, I think is actually an accurate word in terms of their metabolism. In tussock material in these things, they can't process it because they don't have the nitrogen. So we thought that maybe things would look different in winter, but they still seem to be able to just keep chewing this stuff up almost forever. We've not seen any limitation in carbon supply. Okay. When you see BRDU incorporation into DNA, that means actual DNA replication. So with just changes in biomass, if we're just doing, you know, sort of chloroform fumigation or something, then I'm more hesitant. But what we're seeing is, you know, cells are actively synthesizing new constituents and they are replicating. And there have been some other studies as well, you know, that reinforce that conclusion and have seen things using very sophisticated different kinds of techniques also that show, yeah, microbes can grow under these conditions. Slower, but they're growing and replicating and dividing. And that the organisms that are doing that are an interesting small set of the total, I don't want to call it community because I just pulled that question yesterday, but the total collection of organisms that are present in these soils.
So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So now we have to move on to the next.